Hello and welcome to Inside Education on 103.2 Dublin City FM. My name is Sean Delaney and this is the programme for anyone interested in the world of education from an Irish perspective. You can access podcasts of all previous shows on insideed.com. The Standing Conference on Teacher Education, North and South, or SCOTANS for short, is a network of 38 colleges of education, university education departments, teaching councils, curriculum councils, education trade unions and education centres on the island of Ireland, with a responsibility for and interest in teacher education. The organisation held its 13th annual conference in Limerick on Thursday and Friday last. Its theme was Teacher Education for Social Justice. One of the keynote speakers at the event was Professor Kathleen Lynch, who is Head of the School of Social Justice in University College Dublin. She has a particular interest in equality studies and social justice from an educational perspective, and the title of her talk at SCOTANS was There is No View from Nowhere, Ideology, Social Justice and Teacher Education. I wanted to find out more about this when I met up with her after her keynote address, so I asked Kathleen Lynch what her key message was to those present.
Well, I suppose the key message that I had today was that we often think when we speak that we are speaking some objective truth and that our position is held by everybody else and that this is a common sense view, an objective view. And the point that I was making is that we all actually come from a model or paradigm or a way of thinking about the world which is not necessarily objective, which is actually a viewpoint. So from that point of view, people will often say in politics, oh, you're ideological. I remember somebody saying it to me one time when I was on television, oh, that's a very ideological position. But the person didn't seem to realise that their own tradition was equally ideological. It came from a perspective, a view of the world. And that if we don't deconstruct, I suppose, or challenge the assumptions of our own viewpoints and other people's viewpoints, I think sometimes what I was saying today is we are subject often and controlled by dominant ideologies in our time that we're not conscious of at all. That our consciousness is actually framed by systems and ideas which, you know, circulate in the intellectual sphere, in the political sphere, in the media, in education, but we don't articulate them. We don't know them. And because we don't know them, we're not able to name them and we're not in control of them.
But is there not something natural or maybe efficient about the fact that when you meet somebody, you make some assumptions about them in order to have some common ground to start from.
Absolutely, at that personal level, yes. But I suppose I'm talking about major ideas in society. And I suppose the five areas that I looked at were the ideologies around equality of opportunity and how problematic that can be. Well, it's a great idea because I was saying it's necessary but not sufficient. I took the notion of neoliberalism and this idea of the market citizen, how problematic that was. And then I talked about new managerialism as another ideology, how we actually organise our institutions, including schools and colleges, around the principles of the market coming from the neo-managerial agenda, and how problematic that was in terms of only counting and only valuing what can be counted, right? And then finally I spoke about kind of the anti-intellectualism that in Irish life and also the whole ideology of charity as justice. Not the idea that people have rights, but the idea that we will give a little bit voluntarily. Even take the word voluntarism, which is very strong in Irish, voluntary schools. I always found that an amazing term. What do you mean they're voluntary? That implies that somebody has gone out and done a service for you. And it implies that somehow this is something they give out of their beneficence. And it's something extra that they needn't do if they didn't want to do. But education is a human right. It's not a charity. So from that point of view, I think that our understanding of social justice, I'm saying, is influenced by all those ideologies, some of which are global, some of which are more local, and some of which have elements of the global and the local.
Of their nature, ideologies like the ones you've described, they seep in and they're all around us. Yeah. So if you're a teacher or if you're an educator or a researcher, how do you recognise the ideologies that are shaping how you're seeing the world?
Well, what I was trying to say today is that we must always sit back whenever we get a new idea or a book or anything and ask ourselves, who named this world? Who is this person? Where did this story come from? Who funded the research? Very important in the sciences, if you know it. But even that, to go and ask that question, where was it published? Why was it published? What is missing? You know, whose world is being named here and what is not being named? And the point that I was making today, if you take the power of the media has probably more power in framing consciousness than schooling or education. Because, of course, it's ubiquitous. We hear it in the morning, we hear it at night, we hear it when people are jogging. They're always, you know, so. But who controls the media? Who controls the news? There is no such thing as the news. There is a news that is created for you in RTE or TV3 or whatever you're watching by people who decide that this is important information to know. It is not the news, because that gives it an absolute status of certainty and of truth which is not warranted. So what I'm trying to say is we must always look at an idea or a book or a film and reflect back on where it came from. And I think to teach children, and we can do this, to think that way is to be very liberatory, but to do it collectively, to do it by sharing. As I said to you there, I get students to do a very small exercise is to take out books and look at where they're published, who they're published, what their names are, what are their origins, who are these people? Why are all the books published in 3 or 4 major cities in the world that we read? What does that say about North, South? You don't have to teach a geography class. You can just teach them about the power of Europe and the power of the United States to name the world. Because if you have all the publishing houses, all the printing houses, all the journals, then of course the possibility of people from Ghana or Colombia or Ecuador actually naming the world to us is greatly reduced. We don't know their world, but we think in our Eurocentric world that we are the world. So that's what I was trying to get people to think, to take and enable, and students learn that very quickly with practical exercises.
What kind of practical exercises do you
give
them?
Well, I suppose for me as an academic, I would take the reading of something, and I would also take them to say, they don't like to have to do this, who funded it, that research? Why was that funded? Was there something that else that could be funded? What's not been funded? Why is it funded? I think all of those questions will force you to go out there and to look at what you are receiving as knowledge and to say to yourself, oh, maybe it's not as objective as I thought it was, and maybe there is another viewpoint. You know, you could take an economic textbook, you could take several of them, and you could analyse what's missing. But you need to get skills to do that. I'm not saying you can just do it off the top of your head. But it is about learning to think critically about the world in a practical way through the exercises of knowing and always questioning in a collective. Because what you will, if you do it in this, you know, there's a lot of emphasis on the reflective teacher and reflective practice. I don't doubt that's a valuable thing. But it's so individualised. And I'm just saying, in terms of understanding social justice, it isn't an individualised response that we need. We need a collective response, because when you have a group of people naming the world together, you actually create a new understanding of the world.
And how do you move from the individual questioning, which presumably is where the questioning starts with an individual, how do you move from that to a broader group and to build,
you can
shared
have a collective exercise. Yeah, I've done this, like I've required students to go out at the university, which they find very inconvenient, to go out actually, and to do observational work. Now there are sensitivities around this ethically and everything else, and you have to be careful where you suggest they go. But often even to go to supermarkets that are not in their area and see what other people eat. That sounds so basic. But like people often think everybody goes to X, Y and Z, so I won't name the multiples, but when they go somewhere else, they realise, oh my God, there are no buses here. There's no bus shelter here. Some people have a bus shelter, somebody else doesn't have a bus shelter. Why is it that there's, you know, try and get to the west of Ireland by public transport and come back in the one day to West Clare. Good luck. That's all I'm saying. Because sometimes it's only experiential knowledge that actually, and I suppose what I'm speaking academically, experiential knowledge changes propositional knowledge. Even the doing of something, the activity of doing, changes the way you think about it.
So
Does a commitment to social justice then change how you teach every subject, whether you're at primary, post-primary?
I think it could, potentially. But I also think that, I know in one of the projects I was involved in many years ago, they had this thing whereby people were assessed in their teaching practice, social justice. I was a bit sceptical of it because I thought it was a bit mechanistic. But I could see the point that they were making, that it made people disability aware, gender aware, it made them race aware. So I think it doesn't matter what subject you teach. I think the subject itself will always have a dimension to it that will raise issues of equality and justice, whatever it is. I'm not an expert in all subject areas, so I can't speak. But it's singularly evident in many subjects that there is a deliberate exclusion of social justice debates. I mean, I studied history for a while at the university. I mean, it was appalling in my time. There was no social history. There was no women's history. There was no history of colonial states. Like, we learned, you know, basically military and political male history. That was it. Now, how does that frame you what you see the world? How does that frame what then becomes the politics of the world? Even politics itself as a subject. The politics of the family, for example. Do people study the politics of family in the politics department? I doubt it very much. But yet power operates in every institution. Power is in our universities, in schools, in families, in NGOs, it's in local communities, in neighbourhoods, in tennis association. Do we study that kind of power? And if we don't, why do we not study it? Is it because we think that power in the family doesn't matter? So I'm saying, when you start to think about, we'd say, power is an equality problem, you begin to see the study of politics or that completely differently. You begin to see parts of the world, and I suppose the big divide, which I didn't have time to talk about today, is the so-called private world, the world of the family, relationships, and that world is generally left out of most academic analysis because that was a feminine world and it wasn't seen to matter. But in fact, it's hugely significant. It frames everything that we do.
Could it become very frustrating for somebody who begins to question, but who realises that, at least in the part of the world we live in, money talks, and really, how do you actually go against that? Because, I mean, we all have to have a certain amount of money,
yes,
to survive. Yeah. So could it become very frustrating for someone who's always questioning?
Well, I suppose the students often say to me over the many years, they say, the worst thing about learning about injustice is you can never get it out of your head. And many people make sure that they don't learn about it because they don't want to feel uncomfortable. So I think, and when you feel uncomfortable, then you feel obliged to do something. And that's why I think if you don't enable people to know, and if you enable them to remain, you know, literally excluded from that knowing, well, then you can't have a public narrative because it's not on certain people's radar. You can't have a discussion. And that's what I was saying as well today about, like, the lack of critical social scientific subjects in our schools because we don't have it. People don't have the language. I notice that when I read our letters and things that people write, they don't actually know the language, the nomenclature. It's like trying to write music without knowing the notational system. They try to write the social world without knowing the notational system because they don't know the names. They don't know the concepts. They don't know the ideas because they've never learned them. And I think that that's social, scientific, critical, I don't mean just for the sake of it, I mean critical thinking about social justice, is something that we have absolutely deliberately precluded students from having in Ireland because we didn't think it mattered. And people, I suppose many people thought religion did that, which we know that that didn't work. And I'm not saying it couldn't or shouldn't, it's a different debate. But all I'm saying is we do need to have that kind of language in order to be able to analyse the world.
And is the reason that people are reluctant to engage with social justice is because there is so much social injustice?
Well, I think it makes you very uncomfortable. Most people like a comfortable life. I like it myself. You know, when I came home from work, you don't feel almost like, you know, engaging in another activity that may discommode. You might rather sit down and read the paper. But I think if we become socialised to be democratic citizens and practice that in school and reward children for democratic, you know, engagement, that will become habitual. That will become self-rewarding. And it also means it gives children and young people the capacity to be democratically engaged.
You co-authored a book called New Managerialism in Education, Commercialization, Carelessness and Gender. And a second edition of that was published this year. How did that book come about?
Dimna Devine and myself, and then with subsequently Bernie, felt that neoliberalism was having a huge impact on education at every level, primary, secondary, higher, further education. basically we studied primary, secondary and higher education and people being appointed at senior levels and how they're perceived and how they experienced being a manager. That's what it was, the experience of being at a senior level. And I suppose one of the many things that we found in the book at the individual level was this concept of the elastic self. Dimna Devine was particularly instrumental in developing that idea. You know, a lot of the managers, school principals at primary and second level, they felt they were constantly being stretched. They were constantly having to do an infinite number of things because... many things to do with the fact you didn't have a middle management structure. You know, you had religious originally in education and then they left and they did all this voluntary work and then there was no one to fill the void and all that very institutional issue. But there was also the impact of a whole new regime of managerialism, of bureaucracy and accountability, whereby people constantly felt they were never doing enough. And I suppose that led us to look at how this mode of governance of constantly accounting for yourself, constantly reporting on yourself, so that people began to feel they were spending more time accounting for themselves than doing the work that they were actually accounting about. Now, it's not as bad here as in the UK, for example, but a lot of school principals felt it was going in that direction, especially at second level, perhaps a bit more so than primary. And it was very advanced feeling at higher education level.
And how
was... And, of course, some people totally disagreed with it at higher education and some people didn't think it was that problematic.
And how do you see that as linked to neoliberalism?
Well, you see, what I was arguing is neoliberalism about the kind of institutionalisation of market values in all areas of public life. And, you know, if you institutionalise market values, then you value people for what they produce. People are valued as customers and consumers, as producers, but not as citizens. And where we saw it was that people in schools increasingly felt that they were being evaluated and treated as accountable in that very commercial sense. That they had to, you know, that there was a fear of these league tables produced by the newspapers, even though they're not official, weighing hairy heavily on them, often in schools that were under-resourced relative to others. They could not possibly compete, and yet they were supposed to compete. And this absurdity of this, I suppose, and the fact that it had such a negative challenging impact on teachers and on children and people in schools that were relatively disadvantaged. Now, people didn't take those things too seriously, but I suppose what we saw is market values being applied to schools and people fearing that if, you know, they had a very high number of children who were very socially disadvantaged or whatever, that this would give their school a certain status and that they fear that this might impact then on the future of the school. So because when you start to... quantify and measure everything, only what is measured then becomes important. And that was their fear. Their fear was, of course, that the children then who would not be good in producing value, if you like, for the school, would be academically very successful or maybe high achievers in sport or music or whatever, that those children would lose out in that system because they wouldn't give the school the kind of profile it needed to compete in a market environment. So that was probably one of the most important findings. We also found, of course, in higher education, a huge impact and change in terms of monitoring, evaluation, constant, league tabling and ranking, etc., and having an enormous influence on the universities.
And how do you see the interaction between social justice that is caused in society and social justice that is reinforced or promoted in schools?
Well, I suppose you could see it in several areas, but there are many forms of injustice, power-related ones, respect and recognition, and, of course, the issue of care and care for people. But one of the things I suppose I would say is that if you have huge economic inequalities in society, it is inevitable that you will have educational inequalities in examinations. Because people with extra money and power and resources will use their extra money to advantage their own children. There is no society that doesn't occur. People often give out about the exam. You can change the exam and, of course, you can make it worse. Like if you have, as I said today, testing children on work they do at home and you have that as part of public examinations, that is a recipe for social class inequality. But even if you don't have that, you have our system where, there are many issues with it, I know, everything done in school or whatever. But if you have that system, the person with most resources will get grinds, they will get private tutoring, you can call it what you like, they will socially, they will use their money to advantage their own children. So economic inequality is absolutely has to be addressed if you're going to address education inequality. And the more you see unequal, you have created society economically. Nobody wants to be the child or have their child in the minimum wage sector. So everybody is competing against that benchmark. They don't want their child to be there. So if you have a society that is more equal economically, if you like, the relative advantage or disadvantage isn't as great. So then the cost of being maybe at the bottom is not as great as where, you know, somebody is earning 50 or 100 times what somebody in the low wage is earning. So that's what I'm saying is education is a nexus through which class privilege is basically, it's forged. It goes through that nexus. And if you have a very class, a social class unequal society, people are fearful. They're fearful for their children. I remember being visiting a scholar in Sweden for a while. And like you have public examination there, like we have here. But you never had this hype. You didn't have the same hype about it. Because although, yes, there were issues, but also there were second chances. If you didn't do well in the public exam, there was another chance. You could, there's effectively a mature student like Leaving Cert, it's an alternative examination. And also you didn't have the massive income disparities, I suppose, that we have here. They're there, they're significant, but they're not as great. And then there are other inequalities, like if you don't respect people, for example, direct provision, the huge issue, I think, 960, how could a child live on €9.60 a week? That feeds, that comes from outside, that affects children in school. And if you don't have respect for travellers, of course, if you haven't programmes and everything, given proper housing and treated with respect or whatever enabled them to live their nomadic lifestyle, of course that disrespect will feed into schools. So of course I'm saying what we do outside affects what we do inside.
So if you're a teacher or you're a principal committed to social justice, what in your small way even can you do to address the kind of issues you have?
I actually would have to say, I think some of the schools and principals in this country are absolutely marvellous, because I genuinely do believe that. I have seen it. I think they do 1,000 things. I think you can create a caring environment. I think that's the first thing you do, where everybody is welcome. I know that's a, I mean, that seems such a small thing, but there's a lot of research done. Probably I know higher education better at this stage of my life than I know other sectors. That what students remember most from college is not the great academic kind of lectures they had. They remember most, you know, the incidences and times when they were well looked after. And I think that that is what, why people often love their schools, or they love the memories of the schools, is that. And I think an awful lot of things follow from that. If you do that, then you will have institutional structures whereby you will listen to the children. As I said today, it's a small thing to do little surveys or participatory exercises if children are too young to write, to know what bothers them about school, what they love about school, what they hate about school. You can ask 3 or 4 simple questions. What do you fear about school? And then you have a dialogue. You maintain that dialogue. And I think that dialogue and democracy is very important, along with care. And then I think you institutionalize safe spaces for people to speak. Safe spaces are very important, like especially around issues of sexuality, for example, or disability, very sensitive, especially around mental health issues. People don't want to speak about that in public. But like, you need to create safe spaces so that this person is not just defined as odd or different or eccentric, and therefore left in that corner, there's no discussion of, or, you know, you have a very maybe social class divided school, and there's no discussion, there's no analysis in a lot of schools. Everybody just follows their own track. And I literally often use a class track as well in terms of streaming and banding, if that exists. So I think that those are hard issues to address. They're not easy, but we have to learn to do them, because we have to create a dialogue. How did you come to see the world? Do you see it? How do you position yourself? How is it that I see the world differently? And learning to teach children, learning to listen to one another in a respectful way, is a very, very important thing, I think, in schools.
One of the things I've heard you speaking about before is the power of language in how we speak and how we talk about children, even in school. Can you say a little bit about that?
Well, I suppose I have very strong views about how we label people, because I think that language is very, very powerful and very, very positive, or very, very dangerous. So often people use words like people are stupid, or people are thick, or they classify children as A abilities or D. I think those kind of languages are really dangerous. Negative labels like that are really, really dangerous, because if you have a label of being a D student, or, you know, you're given a label of having a test score. Of,
or even a weak student.
Weak. Oh, yeah. That dreadful language of weak.
Yeah. No,
how could you be weak? I think of falling over. A weak student. What do you mean? What capabilities? We are all full of capabilities, and some students just may not have the opportunity. Others may not have the interest. I often say that. You know, of being very academic, but they all have capabilities. They may not want to use them, they may not be able to use them, may not be empowered to use them, they may not have the resources. But that idea of classifying people into those categories, I think it's extremely dangerous, because what you're saying to yourself as a teacher, and I don't have to bother with that student now, because they belong to the weak category, and you create a self-fulfilling prophecy whereby you don't expect things and you don't believe it. And, you know, we know we have numerous examples of that from history in this country. I mean, the history of schools and teaching, whereby certain children from certain backgrounds were put in the back of the class, and et cetera, because the assumption was they would not be good at school. The assumption was they would be weak. And sure, they were, I knew their mother, and their mother wasn't any good at school. I mean, that kind of dangerous talk, and there is dangerous talk. And I think we need to constantly check ourselves and not allow that, and have a discussion of what labels do we use, and maybe what labels should we not use about people in school.
Is the discipline that informs your work mainly sociology?
Yes, it would be. Though I would read across all disciplines. I think in academic life, if you're in an area like education, you can't just read in one area. You have to read philosophy, you have to read psychology, you have to read, you know, history, you have to read policy, you have to read everything. I think that is, I often say I'm an academic. My background was in sociology, but I would read political theory, I would read philosophy, I would read everything. I read economics.
And finally, Kathleen, who or what inspires you?
A lot of people inspire me all the time. But I suppose academically Paulo Freire would have had a huge influence in the way I think about research and how you listen to people and how you think about children as subjects with whom you have dialogue, and not people that you control and manage and manipulate. I think that idea of entering into dialogue to come to know the world is hugely powerful. I suppose other many, you know, Marxist, neo-Marxist theorists, I suppose, like Bourdieu, would have had a huge influence on my life. But also feminists lately, very important feminist thinkers like Virginia Held, and people who write about care and justice, and Joan Tronto. I think they have had a huge influence, Eva Kitté, on writing. They're philosophers writing about the theory of care and justice. And also, yeah, they would have had a lot of influence on how I think about the importance of care and its relationship to education. Nell Noddings, for example, who's written about that in a very traditional way originally, but I think in a very important way. What she did at the time was seen to be kind of, you know, anti-feminist, but I think it was more that the age and generation she came from, she was trying to say something new.
A summary there of some of the people who inspired Professor Kathleen Lynch from the School of Social Justice at University College Dublin, bringing my interview with her to a close. Kathleen Lynch gave a keynote address at last week's annual conference of the Standing Conference on Teacher Education North and South in Limerick. Please write to me with feedback or suggestions to insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie. You can listen to all 225 podcasts of previous Inside Education programmes on insideed.com. But until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney signing off. Have a great week.